Hi, I'm Stacey Shoemaker-Rowan, Editor-in-Chief of Hospitality Design Magazine with HD's What I've Learned podcast. I recently sat down with Lucas Runger, co-founder of Network of Architecture, or NOAA. Hailing from Northern Italy, the architect cites Roman architecture as a major influence on his career. He started out as a professor in the region before he moved to London and cut his teeth with the likes of Softroom Architects and Matteo Thun. It's there that he met his business partner, Stefan, and they started NOAA in Italy in 2010. Their approach is collaborative and holistic, melding the interiors with the architecture and the land, and opting for quality versus quantity when it comes to the projects they take on. Take the recent Gefell Hotel in Italy, which they dub a hotel under a barn, or the Floris Hotel, which integrates itself into the surrounding park. His and his firm's work and the lessons learned along the way serve as perfect inspirations for today's world. Here is my conversation with Lucas now.
All right, so tell me about you. Were you always creative? Did you always know you wanted to do design or architecture from like a young age?
Well, I think so. I wasn't quite sure which creative direction I probably would have taken, but there's actually still a couple of designs of when I don't know why, but I was actually designing sunglasses at the age of 8 or 9. Don't ask me why. It probably has to do with my mother. She's a professor of art and a painter. So in a way, and on the other hand, probably my father, he's more an engineer. So those are potentially the two sides beating in my heart, which are the way then came together to form myself as an architect, to develop my whole mindset and my creativity, to mature it at this time. And so this was kind of the early things that I can think back. And of course, let's be honest, like my mother took me just traveling through Italy and seeing many cultural things. So that definitely had a major impact on my future development, I guess.
Yeah. Where did you grow up in Italy?
I grew up here in the north, so we are actually quite close with our home base studio where I grew up. So it's in the Dolomites. It's sort of a little alpine region touching the borders of Switzerland and Austria.
Oh, nice.
But of course, when it comes to culture, let's say, of course, in Italy, we've got much stronger areas in this case. Here it's much more about nature and trees and cows and snow. And so my mother took me quite a lot to Venice, which is just 2 hours away. So Venice, Florence, Rome are, let's say, almost the first memories, the first thoughts. If I think back, then that was the influence, I guess.
Yeah. Was there a building or a place or anything that like sticks out in your mind as specific that, you know, you're like, oh, you know, buildings are amazing, or, you know, like that you saw like the power of what architecture could be?
Yeah. Well, there were two things, I guess. One is the Pantheon in Rome, exactly. Which in a way is just so indescribably powerful that it's almost stupid to try to explain what's happening there. Because also when you see it on a photograph and when you live it there, when you see what this aura is, but everybody's just becoming silent because of this presence of this building. So that is just, it's just kind of mind-blowing. And that was 30, 35 years ago when I was there for the first time. So I guess that had some kind of major impact with this tiny little hole on the top, which is actually bringing the light in, which is quite amazing. And on the other hand, and this really might sound funny, it has to do with this miniature version of Italy. I know it's a fun park for kids, but it's actually a compressed version of whole Italy where you can run through. And that is sort of, I mean, if you imagine it's a little bit like Alice in Wonderland, you walk through and you see the Torre di Pisa, which is like the thing. But the scale, you know, when you are just, let's say, 2 years, 3 years old, is almost, I wouldn't say the same, but it was so funny to walk through this compressed little Italy. So I have to say that was really the first thing I remember, which I always kept in my mind, being able to touch the buildings that you always only see in magazines and all that stuff. So I touched them all.
Where is this little Italy?
It is near Rimini, which is a very, let's say, a seaside Adriatic Sea location, and it's a very popular area. And so many people, especially when they go on holidays with the families, they go in this area. It's a little bit south of Venice, and of course, this is a cool day trip to have fun and to learn about the country. So it had to do a lot with learning and education and fun at the same time, of course, being a child at the time.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. So did you end up going to university for architecture then? What was your path?
The path was actually a funny one. When I was 13 years old, I was actually quite close to go to an art school in Austria. The only reason why, from what I remember, is I didn't go there because a friend of my mother, he's a painter as well, and he said, oh, if you don't want your son to come back as a drug addict, you shouldn't go there. Because it was a super creative area, but it was a bit dangerous at the time. So I didn't go there in Vienna. And I just took the normal high school that you took kids from until up the age of 18. And then I went to study in Graz in Austria, where I did my first term in architecture. So, and then I moved with this Erasmus program, which is an exchange program. I moved to Brussels, where I lived there every year and also learned French and also the French approach to architecture, which is, let's in a way, very particular compared to other, let's say, European things. And then I did my diploma in New York City, actually.
Oh, really? Where?
I moved there, and it was a kind of field work, let's say, a research work that I did there. And at the end of the day, I chose Dumbo, which you might be familiar with.
Yep.
And I was there. I lived there about 20 years ago. And I lived just off Union Square, and then I moved to, well, quite often for about half a year. So I moved quite often to Brooklyn, where I had this sort of tutor who was helping me out on many things. He was an urban planner in Brooklyn, and he was teaching me quite a lot about this sort of very difficult to access area, let's say, full of artists. I remember Victor Concha and many of those. And I was just meeting people, and I was just, and it was an urban utopia project, you could say, in a couple of words, where I did my research work, and then I came back to Europe to elaborate the work there. But it wasn't, let's say, on a design scale. It was more urban planning and the future of Dumbo for the years to come. And then it ended up in something quite crazy where you had a new city within the city, if you like. Very so cool. that was my trip to the US.
Love it.
And that was the path, if you like, towards Venice, because in Venice I did my, we call it sort of a state diploma. That's what you need to be an architect in Italy. And so that was the qualification exam. And then, yeah, that was my studies, if you like, and that ended up about 18 years ago.
Then who did you work for once you finished your studies?
I actually started off working with one of my professors, which was cool at the time, Professor Hans Gangeli. He is still a professor in Graz. And, of course, we got to know each other already at university, so that helped. And I guess learning from a professor at some point in time is always a great thing, because it's this mind, this open-mindedness, which is always very helpful. But then I got into a little bit of a crisis. Let's say maybe Graz was a little bit becoming too small. So I had to move. I had to break out. And I moved to London in the UK. I lived there for 5 years, mainly working for two studios. But then I switched more from architecture towards the interior design and also the hospitality thing. I actually worked also on the Yotel, which you might know in New York. It started with Yo Sushi, and then we did the Yotel. So that was one of my projects I worked on in London for a company called Softroom at the time.
Oh, yeah.
It was a fantastic time in London, of course, being just surrounded by so many universities as well. I think I went to an opening of galleries every day. It was just this creative entourage, if you like, was a great time. But then I have to admit, at the same time there, I was a classical, if I may say that, a Lehman victim. because the financial crisis in 2008-2009 really eradicated architecture jobs for many people there. The same thing for me, unfortunately. And then I said, what can I do now? And I applied in Milano at Matteo Thun, which is an architect and designer, which you might know. He's quite famous in Europe, I guess. And then I got a job there. And that was my formation until 2010. And then we started Noah.
Nice. So what did you learn from him? Because he is very prolific and, you know, his work is pretty interesting. What did you work on with him?
I worked on mainly projects that were always trying to explore and discover sustainability. I mean, he's not doing it as a work. He's living it in a way. So that was, I guess, one of the main elements that he was always interesting to develop further and go deeper into. But at the same time, I guess, learning from Matteo Thun at the time was that he didn't just consider a project, but it was so much more that he was actually considering to create worlds, because just moving as a client into his studio, you were sitting on his chair, you were touching his Illy cup of coffee designed by him. So you were actually surrounded by something, by a Matteo Thun universe. And that was most definitely one of the most inspiring things. So it wasn't just, let's say, objects or designs or whatever, but it was moods. It was so much more. It was, in a way, it might sound stupid, but it was a way of living that he is transporting. And this communicating that, I think, is probably the Champions League of design.
Yeah. Now, I remember an interview with him and just him explaining, like, you know, how he lives in worlds. And I was just, you know, like, he's always thinking, like, the holistic, the, you know, like, everything surrounding you. He's quite interesting. So what made you decide? I mean, starting your own firm is not a small undertaking. So why did you want to start it? How did you meet your partner? What did you guys want to create that was different? Or why was it the right time to kind of break out on your own?
Well, the reason why we started, in a way, because I guess I met Stefan, who is now my, let's say, co-founder and partner in crime and everything, exactly there. He was a project architect at the time there with Matteo. And he has also a degree in interior design. So, I mean, in a couple of ways, there were some worlds colliding in a positive way and coming together. We also found out only a year later that we were cousins in third grade. So it's family business here almost, which we weren't aware of, which was funny because he's from this region as well. But it took us a couple of drinks to find out what was going on there. And that was sort of the reason why we started. And then, let's be honest, there was one client, which is the uncle of Stefan at the time, who gave us this unique chance to create our first project. So what we did is we took our weekends and our nights started off to work a little bit in parallel during the day for Matteo and during the nights for our own little project, which then evolved. And once we got the planning permits for that, we decided to do it because I learned it a little bit from my mother. She's more the teacher, let's say, and maybe less the creative herself in a way, but she's she has this excellent capacity to teach people how to design and how to paint. So in a way, I have to admit, I'm much more the one who needs to do his own thing. So that was actually the main driver why we said we can't just design for someone else, let's be honest, or to just follow something or just to produce production drawings and all that stuff. As beautiful as that is as well, we needed to express ourselves and let our creativity become alive and not just deliver someone else's ideas. And that was, to be honest, the first reason why we left the Matteo studio in Milan. We came back here to Bolzano, found a little studio and there's only one skyscraper in the city, and we went into there on the top floor, and that was empty. And it was empty for years and nobody understood why. And then we met this old lady about 85 years old, and she said she And we said, this is the most beautiful office in the whole city. Why is it always empty? And she said, she's only hiring it to architects because architects need this 360-degree view, not just up to the city, but onto everything. And that we got it for a very cheap price, and this is how we started it off. And we took it from there, and we were two of us at the beginning, and now it's almost 30 collaborators. And so, you know, step by step, we didn't want to explode, but this was sort of the initial, the beginning, if you right. like.
And what was your first project? What was that project?
It was an extension to an existing hotel in the sort of an alpine region here, as most of the areas are, especially a very particular place. Obviously, hoteliers are always looking for the super places. And so it was a hotel extension, quite small. You could see a kind of 15 suites plus a wellness and a pool area. So not too big in a way to be completely lost, let's say, as a beginner. But in a way, it gave us many chances to fulfill something which we always believed was our aim to find something like a different approach to planning and to conceiving and to perceiving a project. So it's kind of a multidisciplinary approach to things. Well, we say we are more the ones who are the directors of an orchestra somehow, and we always tended to bring in other creatives at a very, very, very early stage.
Right.
So that's almost a little bit of a, you could also call it a methodology of designing, but this richness of different thoughts and different points of view from completely different people was something very intriguing. It is always, of course, hard work to do that. You can imagine if you bring kind of 5-6 creative people with their different ideas, it's not that easy. I mean, even the Vienna Philharmonica, if they don't follow what Riccardo Muti is telling them to do, it's going to, you could, you know, it's a teamwork at the end of the day. It's just if you have a team of players and they don't play together, you go nowhere. So that is just to give you an idea and a hint of what we were trying to do there.
Yeah. No, I love it. And how do you and Stefan balance each other? Or, you know, how do you divvy up roles? Or, you know, talk to me about how you work together and why it works well.
I guess what we... It's, I would almost call it sort of sparing partners, if that is the correct term, in a way that one is always sort of the leader and the other one is just always giving this different point of view. And so it's, in a way, we developed I wouldn't say one is specialized in one thing and one in the other. That's not the case. That was never really the case. We were just sort of two creative minds, where one was going in front and sometimes we really worked together. So one of the first, like this first project, the so-called Valentiner Hof, is really where we were almost like two cooks are doing one meal. We were really giving, almost on a day-to-day basis, one took over and brought his stuff in. So it was an experiment at the same time. I have to admit, though, that changed a little bit, also because of the size of the projects and the size of collaborators. So we're almost sort of balancing it out together, sometimes against each other, when we're criticizing each other in a positive way, of course. But yeah, it's almost a very fluent parallelism, if you like, of working together. And yeah, that would be sort of the description. Also, because character-wise, we're quite different in a way that you could almost say there's two languages in a way, bringing it together, and then at the end of the day, you have a dialect with different nuances of thing. But that is, it's quite interesting. When we are in interviews, the two of us, it takes journalists just a minute to understand in a way how different we are, and that is, I guess, that is so somehow maybe the friction as well sometimes, but mostly it's the creative motor, the driver, which keeps us always busy.
No, that's good. I think you need that, right? You need that push and pull. Can't always just say yes to everything. I love it. Going back to this methodology, so as you've grown and added more, you know, 30 people and moved on to some really amazing projects, have you kept this kind of open feedback? Like, how do you start a project? What's your process like? And how do you run your office? Are they in teams or, you know, does it depend on each project? Or just kind of give some insight to how you guys work.
Starting off the project has a lot to do with, first of all, let's say, I mean, it's all about reading the place and the sense of place and the ingredients that we have there and the context and so much. And also looking back at the traditions and the history of the place itself. On the other hand, just be careful not to become too traditional, too reactive in a way. So it's balancing between action and reaction in a way when it comes to the project itself. What we do is we started actually off, there's always a team, and two or three people are very openly discussing the possibilities we have without too much of a brief by the hotelier. Or let's in this case, when the typology is a hotel. And we chose, and I have to admit, the most successful projects that we did is we spoke a lot in workshops what the people are like, but not so much what they were expecting by the project. Because we're doing it now for quite a long time. If you take away, it's about 15 to 20 years. So most of them, not all of them, but ideally they give us the belief and the trust in us that we know better than them what the future guest will be, because we consider much more the vision, what their place will look like in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Also maybe where tourism is developing to. And that kind of, that gives us the self-confidence and them also having seen past projects and having lived them, they see, okay, there were guys, they actually know what they're doing. They might not do everything right because we're experimenting quite a lot. So if you just look at a couple of our projects, I could, of course, explain, just looking at this Hubertus pool, this cantilevering pool that it became quite famous a couple of years. That was just one thing. It was quite close to be completely crazy to consider that, to plan it, to do it. But at the end of the day, you need a partner in crime, which in this case was the right client to say, okay, it's almost madness doing. Also talking about building costs. Let's not forget a normal pool costs half of that what we did there. But at the time, since 5 years, it fills up his whole rooms. So that was quite interesting in talking about the process of finding the right approach to a project. It's always shaped around the people.
Right.
And not always you have a client who is actually running the hotel. I guess the quality of the projects we had so far is because you always have this family which is running it. So the hotel itself almost becomes like clothes or like a dress, which is then really fulfilling their dreams. It's almost that bespoke dress that fits perfectly. So you much more feel like you're at their home than in a hotel.
Yeah.
And that is sort of, the concept. And then this idea of not so much designing houses, but building stories, and not just telling stories, but building stories is something where we just take, we see the status quo and we take that and we continue the story, because everything in a way is full of stories. They are just hidden. So we try to find them out. We're almost like an archaeologist. We dig them out and we make them alive.
I love it. And I love how you experiment and you push and you innovate and sustainability is, I feel like, runs through your projects, right? Like just it's amazing how you guys look at using the land and the typology and, you know, the footprint and, you know, how it reacts to the land that it's on. I mean, is that something before Mateo that you were interested in, or was that something that was, you know, kind of bred there? I know you said Stefan also was very into it.
Mm-hmm. Funnily enough, the region where we grew up is not so much talking about sustainability. And you know why? Because it's an everyday thing. It's normal. You know, it's not like in London. When I moved to London, everybody started to talk about sustainability because it was almost a thing that really didn't happen that much in the past. You know, there was, but we just grew up. If you talk about regional food and all that stuff, you know, it's very trendy and less trendy, or in a way, it's very en vogue in metropolitan regions. We grew up, we didn't know anything else. So this whole, let's say, sustainability approach that you see also looking at, for example, the materiality and the construction typologies that we use for several buildings is just something, it was always there. So we didn't really have to, let's say, we just really had to reinvent it to remain innovative. This time, that yes, but it's not that we didn't have to reinvent the wheel. I mean, everybody here has always in mind, for example, to potentially create a building with timber.
Right.
So we didn't really necessarily have to convince. Like if you take this Valentino Hof, which is, you know, it's natural stone, it's glass, it's linen. For us fabrics, there were so many natural materials because that's just, it's all over the place here. And it was always there. Even if my grandfather, who is actually, who grew up near this hotel, and he already took the linen to bring down the hay down from the mountain for the cows because they were all farmers, let's say 100 years ago. So that was, interestingly enough, we took what we had and what we grew up with, and we translated that into forms of building. And that, of course, is, yeah, that's sort of our take on sustainability, which, on the other hand, I have to say, is a word that is, I almost can't hear it anymore because everybody is using it. So it's almost a bit overused, I guess. Everybody's, in a way, sustainable as such, but it's this, not so much the sustainable building, but also this sustainable living case, which is a very strong element, which is maybe defining our project.
Yeah, I love it. So what do you think was your breakout project or your big break or put you on the map or just one that early on really kind of started to define what you wanted this firm to be?
There's probably two projects. One is this Hubertus Pool, which in a way is, of course, it's this iconic element. And that took us, it just was all over the place in I don't know how many million blocks. And so if you like, at least from that, from the outside, we became famous with this project. Famous, I mean, it's always relative. And I always try to be very, very humble with this theme of becoming famous. But when they see, are the ones that designed this crazy pool, let's say. So this is this element where we had a hell of a lot of publicity. But I guess for ourselves, this Zallinger project with those wooden huts on above 2,000 meters high, they are probably, well, the ideal prototype almost, if you like, of how to approach a process of how to design, how to detail the building, how to convince also local authorities to be able to build on a landscape, which is a very, very delicate one. So I guess this Zallinger project on the so-called Seis Alm is probably the one where we also two years ago, we won quite a lot of awards with it because there were jurors flying in from New York and they were landing there. They said this is it has this sense of uniqueness, which is very difficult to explain here. Sorry for that. Even the photographs don't really do the job. But when you are there, you're just so remote. It's so far away from anything else. And it becomes in a way so radical in a way that it is just back. It's down to the roots. And at the same time, it is just full of very, very contemporary thoughts, contemporary designs, elements. So I guess this is probably in terms of uniqueness and in terms also of where we love to bring our new clients or people in the thing. And also the most, when people walk in here, it is not as polarizing, if you know. I don't know if polarizing is bad. There's often projects that people love them or people hate them. This one is just, it became a love project for us. And people are just, I don't know, almost everyone is in a way quite impressed by the fact that it is in this very strong dialect with the landscape, and that is quite a challenge for us. But it worked out really well with some fantastic clients.
And then a couple of your new ones. I love the hotel under the barn. What? Giffel, is that how you say it?
Yeah, That was just opened last year. And you can see the barn, and the barn was existing. And the barn, we only did the interiors of the barn. And then on the sloping ground below, we inserted in a terraced typology, we inserted a couple of rooms, which are on the slope, let's say, and very small hotel as well. Again, one of those tiny little loft projects where we also work on bigger projects, but those are the ones where we just, it's always the clients that allow us to produce some jewels. And it was quite good fun to do this one as well. Yeah, one of our most recent ones.
Yeah. I mean, you have some amazing clients. I mean, not everyone gets these types of clients. Do you think they're just attracted to, I don't know. I guess that's just lucky to get some amazing people. Do you think they've just searched you out for, your kind of inventive architecture?
Very good question. The way to get new clients is because they go and see other hotels, let's say. So that is our acquisition of new projects, is when they go to see new projects of ours. And because we are not there to talk about what we do, it's actually the design itself is our language, and the built things are the ones who are communicating to them. And I guess it's that. And as I was saying at the beginning, we often introduce then those stories behind the design. And when a client then comes there the hotel guest, and the owners tell them what the thoughts were behind, then that really impresses everyone, from a little child to very old senior people. I mean, this is something which we always like to do, and which we started off, and that is sort of maybe one of the elements which are the most successful ones. At the same time, maybe talking about the fact that we're not just doing architects, but also interior design and product design, that is one of the main reasons why we are being chosen.
Right.
Because others just do only the interiors, or only furniture design, or only fabrics, or only architecture. So there's also this almost round thing we have the people to be able to deliver the whole project as a Gesamtwerk in this place. No, and that maybe makes the difference. So they just, they don't have five consultants in a way they need to talk to and to balance, but they just talk to us, and we have then here a team of, five, six, seven, eight people with different capacities in different areas. Also when it comes, for example, to the wellness areas. Wellness areas are very complex, of course, and very particular. And I think what we decided really a couple of years ago is that we need to grow in order to have to, it's like playing football. If you don't have a forward, where are you going to go? It's you can't just defend, even though you, I guess we now found a good size in terms of different team members who talk to the client. They're all part of NOAH, but at the same time, it's only a need for an interesting hotel.
Yeah, and talk to me a little bit about wellness, especially this the Affel Hotel, which is gorgeous. So you added a new wellness. You started it a while ago, right? And now you've been building upon it.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was it evolves throughout the years. The first phase we did was about 7 or 8 years ago, but we only did a sauna, like this sauna, which with this sort of round opening, which was the first phase of the construction. And it's very interesting how our design grew with the family, because at the time we were actually, the first phase was for the parents. Now it's their I mean, there was this generational approach to designing something, which was really impressive, you know, first for the grandparents, then for the parents, now for the daughters and sons. And they've already got a little son. He's only 5 years old, but I'm pretty sure in 10 years time, we might be doing something for him. And the latest addition is actually this new wellness area. And we won a competition 10 years ago where we already were considering this, I don't know how you would call it. It is this, well, you could call it an organic approach to space finding and conception of spaces and the place itself there. And this hill, if you like, it's actually a green hill with some elements above, below, and with the new pool area and with this cave-like approach to very enclosed areas like the sauna and the sleeping rooms. That is something where, I mean, they are most definitely the perfect clients, if I may say that. I shouldn't tell them. Otherwise, they say probably they are too nice or whatever. But no, they're so enthusiastic about their thing, about their project that they opened last year. It was difficult with Corona, but we had a decent summer, so it was okay. They reopened now, and they're just not sort of selling the rooms, let's say. They're really living this project. And they are presenting it every day for an hour to all their clients, or to their guests. So it's just, that's what I said at the beginning. We designed this bespoke dress, and they dress it perfectly well, because a dress is only as good as you can dress it, or as you can wear it. And right. And that is just a sort of a short description of the story behind the Apfel Hotel. And next week, they're coming for phase three. So we're starting off already. And yeah, the story goes on, if you like.
Yeah. What's next? What's the next phase?
The next phase is actually, that is interesting, demolishing the old house, which is not of very high quality, but they maintained it because the rooms were okay, let's say. But that is that it's about a three-story house with 20 old rooms. We will demolish that and come up with something special, something new to continue this story. So that is, that would be the thing.
And then last but not least, Floris, which I love. It's so striking in its architecture. Tell me a little bit about that. I love, you know, the park idea and like letting it sit into the landscape. You talk a little bit about your thoughts on that project or the story behind it?
Well, the Floris project is, of course, it's all down to this beautiful park that they have. Of course, it's just within the nature. It's all, I often say, architects, we make a little bit of a mistake to consider too much the built, and we should also consider the unbuilt and the surroundings so much more than we just focus on the built. And there, I guess, with raising those buildings like three houses without touching the ground and almost having this respect of the nature and of the soil at the same time. But again, being very powerful in this expression of those suites, which are actually a bit flying above the soil, above the park. So it's a way they want to be there, but at the same time, they let the nature survive in a way. It's not just about putting down concrete, bam, bam, bam. But in this case, it was a very, a subtle design, I could say. And the idea was just to create those almost cocoon-like worlds where you don't have to go out because you've got those little spa areas, all part of the room. So you can actually go there and it's just you and the park. So that was a bit the idea behind. So those, I wouldn't call it tiny houses, but it has to do a little bit with those smaller units with a very human scale. That was the important bit, not in this case, to have 10 to 12 different characters, which are somehow all similar, but no one is the same. And that was sort of, those were the initial thoughts. And it's also what we quite like about the designing hotels is that the owners, they can test the future guests by doing small interventions. So the intervention of Floris, those suites, it's not that big. We're talking about, let's say, $3 million, $3.5 million, just which is not that much, you know, as a first thing. They could have invested 20, but they didn't want to. They said, let's kind of test the future client with bringing out this small little jewel and trying. I mean, the world doesn't go down if it doesn't work out. Let's be honest. I mean, it's all about thinking in phases, not static, but in a very dynamic way. I often say, as an owner, if you have 10 million, don't spend the most. Just start with maximum half it or whatever. Try to test what is out there, what the future guest will love, will have. So that was, yeah, that was always the outcome of the initial brainstorms for this building. And then it was really built at the end of the day in timber in a very short period of time. I think we had 5 months for all of this, which is not that much.
No.
And it's only works when you have, let's say, the arts and the craftsmanship that is a bit used to it. I think that's one of the advantages in the area. There's almost every second house is a hotel. So also the companies who are building it know what there is to do in terms of timing and costing. Of course, let's be honest, every euro, every dollar counts and is important. So the budgets are always quite strict. I mean, I have to admit, people very often think they are much more expensive, the buildings we create, than they actually are. So we always have project managers and cost consultants who tell us, oh, be careful with this. But with this, we changed though. So when you look at the projects, also, for example, the Zalinger before, our hotels are not showrooms with some super brands in there. Sometimes, of course, they are. But we prefer to design bespoke elements. So, for example, I can see the lamps there at the back behind you. And if that, you know, if examples like that, we all know how expensive lamps can be. Then we often, as we work quite closely to the Northern Italian design scene, which is nice, that's the time where we spend in Milano. We have a lot of contacts there. So we prefer to come up with new proposals and make them bespoke. And quite often they are less expensive than the original ones, which of course are still beautiful, but that is something we learned works really well. And then, of course, as a hotelier, you're the only one to have it, because let's be honest, we started off with a very early design by Tom Dixon, which we used, and we didn't expect it to complete. You know those hanging lamps in things? Everybody had them. You saw them all over the place. And you know, let's be honest, if you choose products which are then exploding in terms of everybody uses them, then you get a bit of a problem because the uniqueness is not there anymore. So,
yeah, no, for sure. Wait, I've never heard an architect say don't spend all your money. That's amazing.
Maybe not all of it, quite a lot. Yeah.
A good amount, but not all. But no, I love that you know, because I was actually talking to someone the other day, and we were saying that beautiful things don't have to be expensive, right? I mean, I think that's the beauty of where design has, I mean, quality and, you know, obviously the materiality and what you use matters, but, you know, ugly is just as expensive as beautiful, you know, and I think there's, you know, something very poetic in what you just said about, you know, building something that like can be a test, can be a phase, can be, you know, like a step in and see how people, but still with the quality and the craftsmanship that you expect.
So, yeah, yeah. I mean, we just finished an apartment in Paris on the Seine, on the River Seine. And you have to imagine, just as an example, we had 100 square meters, so 10 by 10 meters, more or less. But we had to spend 1 million just for the interiors. Now you need to, which is 1 million euro, $1.5 million,
yeah,
which was really different. That is a hell of a lot of money in a way. And you need to start, where do I find the materials to get that? So, you know, we had this carved out wash basin for, I don't know, $10,000. You could also buy it for $300, but you find them. But but it was quite a challenge to say, what am I doing with all this money this time? But it was, at the end of the day, it is absolutely fantastic there. But what the result was, I'll show you the pictures quite soon. They're not finished yet. But, I mean, this is then the other extreme.
Yeah, no, I love it. So what's next? Like, what else are you working on besides phase three? Any other exciting projects that you can talk about?
Well, I guess the one I'm really looking forward to, it's opening in July, and it's an old monastery, which some very young clients, they were actually one was banker, one was a marketing officer, so completely crossover. They left their lives behind in this case, so their future, their professions, and they bought half of an existing monastery. monastery, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. From 1745 or so, so 300 years old. And we converted this into a boutique hotel. This is in Arco, which is northern Italy, a little bit north of Verona. So about 2 hours from here. And we started it off about 2.5 years ago. And that is just so exciting because working within such an indescribable context of all the arches and all the thing, of course, it is all under, what is it, a listed building. Of course, we had to be very careful, but we had this beautiful monastery garden inside.
Oh,
and
cool.
This garden and the new addition is a new wellness area with a pool and a hammam and also sort of new relaxing areas. And that also is in very strong dialogue with the existing garden, all within enclosed by a super high, 8 meter high wall where nobody can walk into and see into. And that is, of course, the context there is just breathtaking. And it's not often that you have the opportunity to work within such an historically important context. But on the other hand, you need to express yourself also with a new bit. And it was quite a fight with the local authority. I wouldn't say a fight, but it was a long journey to get the permits.
Negotiation. I can't wait to see it. That sounds amazing. Looking back, what has been like your lesson learned from owning your own firm and your biggest lesson learned or takeaway, or what do you wish you knew then that you know now, or is ignorance bliss sometimes and just good?
Well, I guess it's quite good I didn't know what was coming. is that what you were just trying to say? Yeah, because if we think back of how many times we just closed our eyes and we were in this naive and this positive way, because if you were just to be rational about everything, you would not do it. So I guess this was probably the thing that you don't always know what's coming, and that it's so good that you don't know it, because otherwise you wouldn't do it and you would never consider anything outside of the box. And it just this, I don't know, this positive naivety helps you to keep on going and not really consider everything. Otherwise, you just get too scared of any troubles you might have. And I have to say, recently, the biggest lessons we learn is that you never know what you learn or when you think, you know, there's so many things you do, we did in the past, and I guess it happens for many people, but you don't know at the time what they're good for. But that only comes out with time. So that is just so brilliant. I mean, as you mentioned Matteo Thun before, we saw so many things that we didn't quite always at the time understand why he was doing it. But years after, you understand, oh my God, this made so much sense in a way. So, take it a bit of time to find out what it was. It's not always just there. It's not the obvious stuff that you learn, but just because something you see and you learn is not interesting that much at the time, there's so many things who will come by the time, you know, when you grow and when you learn and you get a bit older. So in a way, yeah, that might be sort of, it's not this one boom lesson to be learned, but I guess it's not, generally it's just follow much more the emotion than, let's say, your brain or your what you might think, the ratio, no, the rational is something. And that is, we love it. We love designing hotels also for that one reason. I mean, the guest doesn't really come there to count every drink you drink, and because, you know, it's a bit for economical reasons. But it's also about, it's so much more about the feeling that you have there at the time.
Right. No, I love it. Is there a dream project, something you're hoping to do?
Well, I have to say, having lived in London, my dream project would always be the Serpentine Gallery. Wow. Because, of course, it's just designers who are not British, who are foreign designers. And having seen them there throughout the years and the different proposals, is just that is definitely a goal, if you like. That would be just brilliant. And in general, let's say, maybe having more focus on cultural buildings, on that would be something which we are aiming to do, and maybe shifting not away from hospitality in general and from hotels, but definitely more towards, I don't know, I would almost call it the relevance of a building and the importance of that. I mean, we're actually doing another hotel concept, which is going to be a single parenting retreat. So you're not allowed to go in there with a family, but only if the parents are divorced. And when you have real troubles with the kids and so you're in there, there's psychologists helping you out there. And it's not so much about what we do, but why we're doing something. And it's quite different. Let's be honest, within hospitality, it's all about leisure. It's about having fun. It's having about a good time. But we love projects within, let's say, the hospitality theme that are so much more relevant. I mean, just considering living for elderly people, I mean, that is so much, especially in Corona times, it's not so much about fun and having good times, but it's also about why are we doing what, you know, it's the relevance. And those are the ones who then become really real love projects, and where you can, I wouldn't say you can change, but you can definitely improve the society and the people who live in your buildings. I guess that's just the deeper meaning of making architecture.
I guess I should talk about the elephant in the room. I mean, Italy was so hard hit with COVID. What's it been like the last 14 months for you all, and as leaders, as business people, as opening hotels, you know, amidst a pandemic? What has it been like?
Well, it's of course, it's quite difficult to say how tough it was compared to others. We don't quite know, but Italy was really hard, hit hard. We actually have a girl here from Bergamo, which is definitely the city which was probably one of the most hit in a short period of time all over the world. And she was, it was tough times, because we had the big luck to never have to make anyone redundant. So we all continued to work, but from home. So in a way that we're talking about workflow and the possibility not to have to send home people, something we were really happy about. And this is how mainly we handled it, half working from home, half being part of here. But I have to say the solidarity in Italy is something extremely strong. What does this little issue of just wearing masks, and a lot of people, when we then travel to Europe, so why are you wearing masks outside? It's almost a sign of solidarity towards the many victims we had. So that was tough times. But I have to admit, we remained very focused in and also positive. What can you do about it? There's many lessons to be learned. That's what probably a minute ago I was actually talking about relevance, in terms of you're actually, you know, it's all about priorities in a way as well. So what we did then is just almost stripping down to the essential stuff and bringing that further. In terms of planning and new projects, I have to tell you, it was never as many requests we had as in the last months, because people had the time to reflect about what to do, because they probably, some of them, didn't have a job or they had to close their hotels, they had to close their businesses. So this going inside, reflecting about how are we considering future resilience and all that stuff, probably helped people to reshuffle their thoughts and reprioritize their ideas. And I guess that helped us also. We have a lot of requests and a lot of changes where they had different things in mind 2 years ago. They said, no, we are different. We need a different approach now. This much more step-by-step thinking.
Yeah. So has it changed what you are thinking about, or put other things top of mind for you?
I guess it has, just in generally speaking, so much more quality compared to quantity. Like, you know, when you have quick requests for new projects, like looking at our other colleagues of ours, we just spoke to Paul Blackburn, who's a lovely guy from London, and he was at the time consulting Zaha Hadid. And I think she grew at the time from 50 people to 500 in 2 years' time. So just so you know, they were exploding, actually. But for me personally, with all the respect for Zaha at the time and now Patrick Schumacher, how they evolve, it would just be this, the time we spend with the clients is the most precious time. So for me personally, it's even though there would be more projects we could deliver, no, let's focus on the ones we have, and let's just have less projects but more time spending with them, and I think it's down to that. It's the time's short, and especially me personally, I had this health issue a couple of years ago, and since then I know exactly that we shouldn't consider so much the future. It's the now that counts. You never know how long things are happening. So I guess this is hopefully some very positive output of all the troubles we went through. And I guess this is probably key to our future work.
Yeah. And you've gotten some time with your little kids. So
yes, exactly. Now they are happy. Because we were traveling, we're just every week in on an airplane, you know, you can't imagine how that is, having kids yourself. So I guess, yeah, it's just quality, yeah.
I went away for 2 days for like a girls' weekend and my children lost their mind. I was like, Mom used to travel every week. Like, what's going to happen when I start traveling again? Because half of what we do are events. Hopefully we'll get you over to the States at some point. Yeah. But like, we do 16 events a year. Like, I travel all the time. Like, and then there's the other, you know, investment conferences and whatever that I go to. So just crazy. But anyway, well, I loved talking to you. It's such a pleasure. We are such big fans of your work, and I love meeting you and it's everything. I don't know. You just seem like an incredible soul. So thank you for taking the time.
Sounds good. Well, thanks for having me. And anytime soon, we're always, always there for you.
Thanks for listening to Hospitality Design's What I've Learned. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find full episodes and transcripts at hospitalitydesign.com.